Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are still waiting to hear from the president about Afghanistan, and if you've been listening to the radio like I have this morning, that's all you're hearing about. Will he take the recommendation of General Stanley McChrystal, his commander there, and add some 40,000 troops on the ground there, or will he focus his military efforts on targeting the Taliban terrorists, especially in Pakistan, with special forces? Or will he see some sort of hybrid of the two policies? Here to help us sort out the issues is Sean Kay. He's a professor of politics and government at Ohio Wesleyan University. Sean is also a Mershon Associate at the Mershon Center at OSU. And he is the author of Global Security in the 21st Century, The Quest for Power and the Search for Peace. Welcome, Sean.
Good morning.
I guess just let's talk about Afghanistan. One thing I'm curious about, the timeline. Listen to the congressional Republicans, and they say ASAP, but Secretary Gates is saying he needs some time. Back off.
Right. For the president to make his decision. I think that's very reasonable what Secretary Gates is saying. The country has been, if you think about timelines, the country has been at war now in Afghanistan going into 9 years, we are now considering a new strategy which could commit the United States to another minimum of 2 years to 10 years that will have substantial costs and consume substantial resources, both human and treasure, of the United States, with a marginal prospect for success. So those timelines are significant. So the President of the United States needs to take this counsel very wisely and look at as many different options as possible. And I'm very glad to hear the President say that we got to get rid of this artificial straw man, that it's either all in or all out, that there are options in between, which I'd be glad to talk about in a bit here. But one other thing about the timeline, timelines are important. I mean, more tactically, General McChrystal has said that we have 12 months, basically, to get this right, that we may not guarantee victory, but we can definitely lose it in 12 months. I worry that we're already at that point, actually, and that we need to rethink the entire set of assumptions that are going into this. But to rush this decision would be folly. However, it does make sense. I mean, if you want to start, if you do decide you want to deploy more forces into Afghanistan, if you want them there by late spring, you've got to make that decision now. You know, so the timelines there are significant also. But finally, one last thing. Mm-hmm. I hear what you're saying about the pressure coming, especially from Republicans, to move this quickly. President Bush took 4 months to decide on the surge into Iraq. I didn't hear the same people making those complaints then. And I also do have to say, I mean, one of the reasons we're in the problem we're in right now is because a lot of these same people so adamantly advocated and supported that we go into Iraq. Had we fixed Afghanistan when we had the initiative and had the opportunity, we would not be in the mess we're in right now.
Why you call that Plan A, which we did never got to Plan A, and it's too late now. But Plan A, if we had done it back 9 years ago or 8 years ago, what would we have done differently? They wouldn't have been as entrenched.
Well, there's several key pivot points, but had we really resourced the war in Afghanistan at the outset, we would have had a much bigger prospect for success. Remember, back to December of 2001, we really had the Taliban and al-Qaeda very much back on their heels. But we then, of course, as people know, took our big strategic eye off that and put it into Iraq, more or less. And from that point on, we just never ever resource the war in Afghanistan, and General McChrystal very rightly points that out in his excellent report of the situation there. But if you want to fight counterinsurgency, you have to defeat the insurgency in its ascendancy, or prevent one from coalescing in the first place. And so this is where I've actually switched my position. I believe that we have the right strategy being recommended right now, but it's tragically 3 years too late. Had we surged 30,000 troops into Afghanistan when the Taliban were back on the rise in 2006, I think we would have been in a much better situation than we're in right now. But we didn't do that, and choices were made, and now we're where we're at. But The average length of a counterinsurgency, a fully resourced one, at least historically, runs anywhere from 5 to 10 years, and those are in less complex situations than what we confront in Afghanistan.
I was listening to an interview on BBC with a general from, a retired general from the UK, and he was saying that he was referring to the surge in Iraq and saying you really can't compare them, although there are parallels. Why can't we compare them?
Well, I wasn't there in Iraq, so I don't want to. I would want to listen to people who were there who really saw it happening. But there are some things that are comparable. That, you know, for example, in Western Iraq, the local population did rise up and turn against Al Qaeda in Iraq, and that's the kind of thing you'd like to see inspired in Afghanistan. But the two big differences are that just Iraq is actually, ironically, a more straightforward place. I mean, it's complicated in some areas, especially like Baghdad, but it does have three major kind of population identities, right? And Afghanistan is just so complex in terms of the tribal makeup that it's just almost impossible to have an overarching concept for the whole country, especially when you think about building the army and army training and police training, just because of the tribal makeup. The other problem is that the surge in Iraq was, in my opinion, a very well-designed and, in the end, a well-implemented tactic, but it in itself was not a strategy. The strategy was to create a set of strategic conditions that would reinforce faith in the government there in Iraq, and that did happen. So skeptics of that were wrong. But what didn't happen was a sustained successful regional diplomatic follow-up. And at the end of the day, if you look at the force numbers in Iraq, we're still surged. we're still up there pretty high. And there's still a lot of violence coming in Iraq. And journalist Tom Ricks has called this the unraveling, that there's still a huge problem in Iraq that has not been resolved because the comprehensive strategic approach to it was not and still hasn't really been fully engaged. So Afghanistan is just a completely different set of circumstances, and I would argue that to just say, well, the surge worked in Iraq, therefore that's what we should do in Afghanistan. That's not what experts are really saying, but it's out there in the public discourse,
right.
And I think that would be a mistake.
You mentioned confidence in the leadership in Iraq among Iraqis. That's a big issue in Afghanistan as well. President Karzai just doesn't have the support of rank-and-file Afghanistan residents.
There are three crucial changes in the strategic environment that really are mandating this new strategic look that the president, I think, is rightly taking. The first is the election in August, and the people who are involved in that just say it was a disaster. And so you can't win hearts and minds if you're there trying to back up a government that simply doesn't have legitimacy with the Afghan people, especially in the southern parts of Afghanistan where the Taliban really have their tentacles. That's a problem. The corruption that goes along with that is a fundamental problem. The second key thing that's really changed is that the Taliban, the population has increasingly become Talibanized in southern Afghanistan. And so being able to win hearts and minds down there is going to be very, very tough. And that leads me to a third real serious concern about the idea of sending more troops into southern Afghanistan, especially for combat operations, which is that the way it is in southern Afghanistan right now, we would have to fight back to get territory. We would have to hold that territory with a sizable amount of troops. And what worries me is you could succeed in that, but push these same Taliban tighter into the hands of al-Qaeda and push them over the border into Pakistan. And that is actually the strategic center of gravity of the entire conflict. If they push them into Pakistan and the Pakistani government cracks down on them, then that might be okay. But if it pushes them into Pakistan and it leads to more instability in Pakistan, then we have a huge problem.
When you say Talibanized, do you mean that the people there are embracing them more, they're more entrenched in the population?
Well, even if they don't like the Taliban,
right,
they have nowhere else to turn because we have never had a sufficient amount of presence in that region to actually hold the territory. And so what's often unfortunately happened is that when, because we had never had enough troops, we would have to call in air power to support our troops, either attack helicopters or heavy bombs, and those end up, you know, maybe hitting the target you want to hit, but also doing a lot of civilian damage in the process. So our troops have been really put in a bad spot down in southern Afghanistan. But the other part is, and this is where it's even more complicated, which is that the Taliban, and this is what I think they're probably debating to a degree inside the White House now, but the Taliban have local territorial objectives. Al-Qaeda are global jihadists. Now, and those are two different things, but the way it's going right now, they are married up with each other because they share the same common enemy. And then there, you add to that a much more deeply entrenched Pashtun kind of nationalism in southern Afghanistan that ends up, which is part of just a decades-long Afghan civil war, actually, that ends up conflating all of those things together, making it a very difficult tactical operation, A, to split the Taliban from the Al-Qaeda that are still pushing out of Pakistan, but also to really get that population-centered focus of mission to really turn against the Taliban.
In Pakistan, what are they hoping for?
In Pakistan?
Yeah.
They meaning the government?
Yes.
Well, that's a great question.
Apparently not an easy one to answer,
yeah,
probably.
Well, it's complicated. Let's put it that way. It depends who you ask. If you ask people in the Army, they want, you know, what they want is equipment and supplies, and they want to make sure India doesn't get a foothold
right
up into Afghanistan. They want to, you know, keep the Kashmir issue kind of separated from all this. They want to, but this is what's also really important here. And having talked to some people that have just come back from Pakistan, what I hear them saying is, and I think this is accurate, that there has been a shift in Pakistan in the public mind towards the Taliban. They came, you know, much closer into the country. They also saw the attacks in India last fall in Mumbai, and a lot of average Pakistanis, as I understand it, kind of looked at this and said, you know, we really don't want to go there with these guys. And so that was important because that public shift, that sentiment, you know, it really had very little to do, frankly, with American policy and American efforts, but it did allow the Army to be prepared to take a more assertive stance in the territories in the northwest part of Pakistan that have been infiltrated by both Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. A much more complicated question is what's going on inside the Pakistani intelligence services, and that's really tough. I think even the commanders of it don't have full capacity to exert command and control over what's going on at the lower levels of their intelligence services. But at the end of the day, you know, the other way to ask that question is, what do we want out of Pakistan?
Mm-hmm. Right,
and,
right. Well, yes.
And it's pretty far-fetched, actually, to think that these, you know, the government of Pakistan would collapse and Al-Qaeda would get a nuclear weapon. That's many, many steps down the road of crisis. But it's sort of the nightmare scenario. But what we really want is the Pakistani government to really put the pressure on the Taliban and Al-Qaeda that have gone into these northwest federal territories. And if they won't do that, then this surge into southern Afghanistan is almost, if we were to do it, would almost be pointless because, again, all it would do is further push them, entrench our enemy into the key center of gravity, which is Pakistan.
We're going to have to take a quick break. I'm speaking with Ohio Wesleyan University professor and author Sean Kay about the options that lay before us now in Afghanistan and other foreign policy issues. If you would like to join the conversation, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU NPR News.
I'm Neil Conan. This week on The Political Junkie, we go back in time. Pulitzer Prize winner Taylor Branch on his 79 remarkable meetings with Bill Clinton while he was president. The book is called The Clinton Tapes. Plus, Ken Rudin on Nancy Pelosi's trip to a U2 concert. Republicans and healthcare, maybe? without you. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins later this afternoon. It starts at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 52 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1021. Sunshine in the forecast for today and a high around 60 degrees. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820.
Support for WOSU comes from the McCoy Center for the Arts, presenting an evening with Jeanette Walls, author of The Glass Castle, Thursday, October 15th at 7:30 p.m. at the McCoy Center for the Arts in New Albany. Information is online at mccoycenterforthearts.com.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm speaking with Professor Sean Kay. He is a Mershon Associate at Mershon Center at OSU. He is also a professor of politics and government at Ohio Wesleyan University and the author of Global Security in the 21st Century, The Quest for Power and the Search for Peace. Sean, let's go back to Pakistan real quick, what we want, what the U.S. wants out of Pakistan. There's several million dollars at stake right now if Pakistan follows through with its promises to fight the Taliban there. Is there not?
Oh, more than that.
Okay, billions? Is it billions? Okay,
yeah,
seven.
Well, that's one of the levers that we have, which is aid to Pakistan. And one of the things that Vice President Biden has been focused on, I think rightly so, for a long time, has been how is that aid delivered? Where does it end up? And what's really happened is that a lot of that aid over time has gone to the Pakistani army, and they use it to buy equipment and stuff, and a lot of that's really with their objective with regards to their concerns that India has very little to do with what we're trying to achieve. But even more important, the aid that we've been giving has not done a good job of getting down into average Pakistani society. And so, again, we want to make sure, the tipping point here is to make sure that fewer people gravitate towards global jihadism, not more. And one way to do that is to make sure that our use of aid and incentives is used effectively.
Fighting in what we think of as a conventional war and fighting terrorism are two different things. Caller from Worthington has a question about that.
Great.
You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I would like to ask a professor if George Kennan's containment policy, theory and policy implemented against the nuclear Soviet Union, we won. I was wondering if this could be applicable to fighting terrorism. Mm-hmm. I think that the Afghanistan war from day one, it was a wrong strategy to fight terrorism, to eradicate Al-Qaeda. The Osama bin Laden, he is still at large. And I feel that it's time for us to realize we made the big boo-boo here.
Well, let's get that answer.
Yeah. I really appreciate the question. Thank you. I don't agree on the latter part. I think the Afghanistan war after 9/11 was the right war. It was the right thing to do. It had an incredible amount of legitimacy and global goodwill. The problem is we didn't stay the course, frankly. We did not complete the mission. We did not support our troops that we sent in there, and we did not do the sufficient steps that were necessary to prevent the situation that we're in now. I believe this could have been, that was plan A, resource the war and win the war. But plan B, in my opinion, is not the limited counterterrorism strategy that some have created as a straw man. Plan B, in my view, is containment, actually, and so I'm really glad that you asked that question. I wrote an article on foreignpolicy.com that got some attention in early September with the title From Counterinsurgency to Containment. And now, to be fair, containment, as you described it, with regard to the Soviet Union, clearly is not the same kind of thing we can talk about here, because containment had a much more state-driven focus. It had deterrence put in place and so forth. But what I'm really talking about in Afghanistan is containing the situation from getting any worse than it is right now. And so the question is, how do we achieve that? the president was right to send 21,000 more troops earlier in the year, because we needed to do that to just stop the bleeding for a bit so that we could have a pause to assess the next best steps forward. But containment against asymmetrical threats is very difficult to achieve, because you need a wide range of tools. You can't just draw a line, for example, at the Afghan-Pakistan border. It's impossible. You just can't do it. But there are some key pressure points that I think are useful that would make a good middle road strategy here. And they involve focusing primarily the military mission on training the Afghan army and police forces so they become the lead operational side of the equation, recognizing the reality of where the Taliban are on the ground in southern Afghanistan, and basically falling back, frankly, from combat operations in that area, using intelligence to the extent that we can to attack concentrations of terrorists in southern Afghanistan and Pakistan where we can find them, and then really try to get the Pakistani pressure from the other side. But really, to me, containment is also a matter of how you lean, basically. And what I'm suggesting is that we should, rather than leaning forward and doing combat operations in southern Afghanistan, we should basically lean in the direction of consolidating the areas that can be consolidated in Afghanistan, rapidly accelerate the training of the army and police forces, which is a very difficult proposition, I have to say. And we have lines of supply in northern Afghanistan that have never been attacked before. They're now being attacked. So we've got to fix that problem before we can start, thinking about spreading out further into southern Afghanistan. But right now we need to contain that, and in particular, again, making sure that that we don't push them over the border into Pakistan. But one final point I'll say about mm-hmm. containment is that one of the beauties of it was that Kennan wrote early on was that the Soviet Union sowed the seeds of its own destruction. The ideology was just so fundamentally flawed and so counter to the needs of people that it would eventually collapse. I think that's true of the Taliban. So the real question is, how do we get the Afghan people to take responsibility for their future so that they go after the Taliban and they make sure this doesn't happen? Right now, General McChrystal is basically saying, as I read it, if we don't act, that won't happen. And I take that as accurate, but the question is, how do we pivot on this? And there's just one last thing I'd add to this, which is hearts and minds here in the United States. Mm-hmm. If the American public is going to be asked to sign up for another 2 to 5 to 10 years of war in Afghanistan, then they have to have an accurate reading of the costs of that, and they do deserve an exit strategy. They deserve a sense of what the mission will look like and how we can call it success. I was really alarmed when Ambassador Richard Holbrooke made a comment earlier in the summer that we will know what success looks like when we see it. That's not acceptable, in my opinion. The American public, who are paying for this and paying for it dearly with their soldiers' lives, deserve to know what the end state will look like here and what to expect. And I think there are measurable metrics we can do to move in that direction, for example, on the Army and police training.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Getting back to the training and of the Afghan Army and the police forces, how much is the success of that affected by the issue of the government and the trust in the government?
Oh, it's significant. I mean, there's corruption all throughout society, including and especially in the police. And so that at the local level, of course, raises grassroots questions of confidence and, what the government's for. The idea of a government of Afghanistan itself is just really questionable, because it's so divided up into so many different tribal makeups and so on. And so that raises the question, how can you have a cohesive Afghan army or national police force at all, even? I mean, it's a real problem. And I'd add to the people we're training, they have huge equipment problems, they have retention problems and desertion problems. The estimates are 80%, although troops I've talked to that do training say it's much higher, but at least 80% illiteracy in the Afghan army. Only 2% speak English that we're training. These are just basic kind of difficulties. Sustainability of the force, if we're going to really increase the size of the Afghan National Army, that's going to be a really difficult prospect. But frankly, it is our only real exit strategy right now, as far as I'm concerned, because if we don't leave at least some capability in place, including equipment, which they don't have, then there really is a danger of the country collapsing and the Taliban coming back in.
You know, when you were talking about maybe putting 40,000 more in, or that could lead to a war that could last minimum 2 to 10 years. But from the way you describe the prospects of the training of the army and the police forces, that sounds like a 2 to 10 year operation as well.
Yes, but it shifts the center of gravity onto the Afghan people for responsibility, and it also takes us, quite frankly, out of the lead role on combat operations, which I think will be more appropriate in terms of sustaining American support for the mission, and let alone the Allied support for the mission. But this has to be looked at too in a broader set of assumptions. I mean, General McChrystal's report says we have to do this in 12 months. We have to achieve unity of command. You got to remember there's NATO involved here, right, too, which has a huge, complicated command structure. We don't have unity of command there. We have woefully insufficient trainers for the Army and police forces. The police probably still has to be redone from scratch. We don't even really have a program in our country for training the trainers to go over there and train. So that alone is really difficult. There's another fundamental assumption that is important to all this, which is that General McChrystal rightly notes that we have to fully capitalize and resource a civilian surge of civilians going over and do much of this work. That hasn't happened. President Obama announced it in March. It just hasn't happened. There is not a civilian surge capacity. So if we want to have a civilian surge, we want to have the trainers, and we want to have a working Afghan government that has legitimacy, and we want to have unity of command. General McChrystal says we have to fundamentally transform the operational culture of the ISAF forces, and all that has to be done in 12 months.
What's the magic of 12 months?
Well, that's his assessment of the timeline that we have before this really gets much worse. I think he was really surprised by how bad the situation had gotten, especially in southern Afghanistan. And so 12 months is his timeline that he said. I don't know if that's the right, give or take. But think about the things I just described. I mean, these are massive, massive heavy lifting concepts. So you're right. I mean, the Afghan army and police training also could take a long time. And by the way, it might take more troops just to do that. I mean, but basically what I'm suggesting is that we can accomplish this new kind of focus without sending more troops, or at least significantly more troops, that we could redeploy the troops that we currently have there.
You know, in that same paper you wrote, article you wrote for foreignpolicy.com, you mentioned the issue of nation building in Afghanistan. You said it's not a vital American interest. What do you mean by nation building? Do you mean setting up government, rebuilding the infrastructure, training the army? And you also mentioned in the same sort of the same breath, if you will, that it is a moral issue.
Yes.
But it's not necessarily a vital interest to the vital American interest. What's the difference? Because aren't we sort of into our morals in this country, or at least apparently?
We like to think that we have a very moral foreign policy. Oftentimes that has been contested. The bottom line is we don't do nation building very well. We have tried it in Somalia. It did work pretty well in Bosnia, but even Bosnia has been of late starting to unravel a bit. You've really got, if you really want to do those things, then again they have to be fully resourced. And we have always had a big sort of ambitious sense of what we can do, but we've also had a very sort of reluctant sense of really wanting to commit to these kind of things. But this really is, I think, the essential question that people are debating. And this is really where I do personally, I think General McChrystal's report and the assessment is all right on spot, up to the point where I do think that what we're being asked to do is to commit to basically building a nation that doesn't really exist. And the key thing that hinges on that is the election in August with Karzai. And And we can't build a nation if there's not a legitimate government, first of all, because you just don't, you can't infiltrate it down into society. And then in addition, you know, we're just not going to ever be able to really provide the resources that are really going to be necessary to achieve that objective. So I keep going back to, for me, to a basic marker, which is that if we're not willing to provide the resources, and by the way, 40,000 troops is what's being talked about in the press.
Right.
I'm not persuaded that's enough. That's what worries me more than anything, that 40,000 may not be sufficient. And if that's the realistic number for an increase of troops, I'm not sure that's enough troops to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish.
Other numbers have been in the hundreds of thousands.
Well, it depends how you measure counterinsurgency force to population ratios, but the general number that's out there is that relative to a country the size of Afghanistan, you probably need about 500,000 troops. In a way, if you really focus on building the Afghan army combined with more U.S. and NATO troops, you can get to something kind of near that, but whether it will be operationally effective or not is a completely different concern.
Okay, we're going to take another short break. I'm speaking with Sean Kay. He's a professor of politics and government at Ohio Wesleyan University. We're talking about some history in the making here, how the president will use the advice of his commander in Afghanistan and other foreign policy issues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. We'll be right back.
This is Capital City Radio.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. This week, Jim.
And this is Capital City Radio.
I would rather go blind, boy.
Capital City Radio is the center of music and news. The new service from WOSU. Online at capitalcityradio.org.
And good morning. You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides will be here. We'll discuss Ohio's $800 million budget shortfall and Governor Ted Strickland's proposal to freeze a scheduled tax cut with a panel of State House reporters joining Ann Fisher in the studio. That begins at 11 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Integrate, helping to improve business performance through brand design and marketing communications for more than 20 years. On the web at integrateinc.com or at 614-421-0004.
Currently 53 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine this afternoon and a high of 60 degrees, a little bit windy with wind gusts of up to 30 miles per hour at times. Clear skies tonight and a little chilly with a low of 42, mostly cloudy for Thursday with a slight chance of afternoon rain and a high of 65. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio Wesleyan University Professor of Politics and Government Sean Kay has joined us today to discuss the question before the president and really the rest of the country. You mentioned earlier, Sean, that this really needs to be a national discussion, and a lot of the way people are getting their information are from leaks, including the memo, and a caller, Mark, wanted to talk about General McChrystal and how he's publicizing his views. Mark, you're on the air.
Good morning, folks.
Morning.
Several things, just quick points here, and I'll listen off the phone.
Okay.
Firstly, why is the right end of the political spectrum being allowed to frame this in a manner that conveniently forgets that this is a leftover from the Bush administration when they went tearing off into Iraq?
Okay, that's politics. Yeah.
Go on. Right. Secondly, Afghanistan has been an empire breaker for centuries. What makes us think we can do any better with the internecine and tribal hatreds and divisions that have been going on in that benighted country for centuries?
Okay.
And thirdly, really, why is General McChrystal talking to the press? It is not his place.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I'll listen off the phone. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, those are excellent and important questions relative to where we are nationally in this discussion. The first point about the, I guess, the politics of it, it's Well, we did discuss this a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. but I think that it is a little hard for me to hear people who for 8 years very much neglected this now saying that, you know, the president must do this or they won't have his support. And by that I mean some key members of Congress. I think they have tempered that a little bit, and do recognize that, for example, there's been a lot of focus on General McChrystal, but you know what the president has rightly said is that, look, I mean, General McChrystal was asked to do an assessment of what it would take to accomplish a counterinsurgency mission, basically, in Afghanistan. He was not given a mission, for example, to write a report of what it would take to implement a containment strategy in Afghanistan or just a pure counterterrorism strategy. If that was what he was asked to do, you know, he would have probably come up with a very different report. I do quibble with that it's too much of a straw man of all in or all out. But I think what's happening now is the president is getting a range of options, and he is getting the right advice from the State Department and the CIA and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of the Army and others who have to look at a global picture as well as just Afghanistan. They have to look at Afghanistan and Pakistan as well as just Afghanistan. And one other point I'd really point to is General Jones, who is the National Security Advisor. He has an incredible amount of experience in Afghanistan, probably more than anyone dealing with this issue right now. And, you know, he said on the weekend that Afghanistan is not immediately on the verge of collapsing, that we have some time to get this right, and that it's vital that we get the strategy right. And General McChrystal himself has said, let's not. It's the wrong focus to focus on, you know, what's the number of troops. The real issue is the strategy. If you apply a different strategic concept, then you'll come up with different kinds of troop ratios. But it is, in my opinion, really unfortunate to see people who really, in some respects, bear responsibility for the neglect of Afghanistan by shifting the resources into Iraq. But you know what? We are where we are. And right now the country's in a crisis, and we have to move forward in a way that benefits our national interests. The second part of the question—
empire breaker.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's obviously what— people worry about that you know, the British tried this in the 1800s. For thousands of years, people, over a thousand years anyway, people have tried to you know, deal with Afghanistan, and you know, it just it's a tough one. It's a really tough nut to crack, and so we tend to think, well, we can do it. Like, you know, we know how to do these things. We can do it right. And I think there's a lot of really good, you know, gung-ho attitude in the military that they can do it. And I think they probably can if it was to be fully resourced. Had it been fully resourced 3 years ago, they could have done it. And if it was completely fully resourced now, I think they would do everything they can in the service of our country to implement this mission. I just don't think even 40,000 troops is going to be enough. Now, the final question was about General McChrystal and the more public debate that's going on. I'm a little torn on that one, but because I think he was asked to do something. He reported what he was asked to do, but things have changed since he did the report, especially the election. So the assumptions have changed a bit. But, you know, he's a general in the field who was asked to complete an assignment, and he's done it. And, you know, so if he's asked a question about it, then he has to answer it. But I think it would be I think I would basically agree with Secretary of Defense Gates that those questions should be answered through the chain of command, not mm-hmm. not through the press.
General McChrystal seems like he's becoming something of a personality, you know, on the lecture circuit or something. You know, they did a big spread on him in Newsweek last week. He was giving a speech in London yesterday or the day before. Is that typical, or is he being sought after now as a voice?
Well, I mean, he's actually, you know, fairly new to the command there, so he's a new face. And you know, it is true. I mean, look, one fundamental principle that has to be reminded of is that the civilians make the decisions and the military implement them. That's the core of our democracy. But on the other hand, the civilians have to get really good advice from the people who really know what they're doing, and General McChrystal's one of them. Again, it would be better if it was through the chain of command. But on the other hand, you know, the comment where he kind of ruled out Plan B, basically, or Plan C, I'm not sure which one it was, but that was asked in a Q&A part of a question. It wasn't something he really went to offer up. And, you know, it would have been better, to have basically said there's a range of options that we all want to look at. But I think at the end of the day, he's an outstanding public servant. The country owes him a debt of gratitude. And what he has said is that we need a new strategy. So, you know, if a new strategy comes in and it's different than the one he was initially asked to write on, then I think he'll implement it to the very best of his ability.
That is Sean Kay. He is an Ohio Wesleyan University professor of politics and government. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we have an emailer now who wants to talk brass tacks, I guess. It's from Carol. She asks, how can we afford to continue in Afghanistan and Iraq? We have a huge debt already, and the politicians won't raise taxes. If it's worth fighting, isn't it worth paying for?
Mm-hmm.
Has that ever stopped us before?
Well, the wars in Afghanistan, it's a great question. Thank you.
Yeah.
The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were paid for off the regular Department of Defense budget. That's changed now. President Obama said we have to be truthful about, you know, how we're spending our money. But remember, we're still spending a massive amount of money in Iraq right now. And I think that, you know, one thing missing from the equation, and again, this isn't General McChrystal's job, but people in, you know, the political experts and others, financial people, the budget people, have to come up with the, you know, these things cost money, and they cost significant amount of money. Now, I don't know. You know, we haven't gamed out what this would cost to go into Afghanistan, but Senator John Kerry has emphatically made this point that those who are arguing for sending more forces and for a sustained longer-term commitment to Afghanistan do have an obligation to be very clear to the American public about what the relative costs are of what they're talking about. And it's not just, by the way, financial cost. It's the cost on the third, fourth, and fifth tours of duty to our servicemen and women that are there in Afghanistan, and the cost to their families. It's the relative cost to strategically, you know, if we're putting 40,000 troops into Afghanistan, that's 40,000 troops that aren't available somewhere else if we have a major crisis that they're needed for. So those are the kind of big picture questions that the public really owes an answer to. But I also think, and this is one place where I would disagree respectfully with Secretary of Defense Gates. I understand why he said it, but he said we shouldn't be talking about exit strategies. I think he means we shouldn't be talking about, like, immediately getting out. And no one is talking about that, at least in the administration. But the American public, and I'll say this again, deserves to know what an end game looks like. And they need to know how much this is going to cost. And they need to know we have a sense of achievable objectives. If they have those things, I think the American public will support staying in Afghanistan. If they don't have those things, then I think we end up fighting a war over there where the country is not involved in it. And absent a draft, we're already missing that.
I'm going to turn to OD now. Those are initials. Wants to talk about who our enemies are and who they are not in Afghanistan. OD, you're on the line. Thanks on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, thanks for having my call, and I really appreciate for bringing such a relevant subject in today's politics. I served in Iraq for a couple of tours, and I'm just running a parallel between Iraq and Afghanistan because we're still behind the ball, behind the curve, on picking up on intelligence and knowing who our enemy is in Afghanistan. And the current level of the request that the general in charge requested, I think it's not going to matter at this point, because what is lacking at this time is the strategy of using those troops and or not using what they already have. It's not there in Afghanistan, because when I was in Iraq, everyone knows that a lot of people think that the search actually worked because of the number of troops, extra troops we had. And you know, anyone that knows anything about military or military strategy knows that was not the case. What has worked in Iraq was we had a strategy that worked, and the strategy was, instead of we stopped We stopped collateral damages and a lot of heavy-handed counterattacks and that sort of thing, and commanders on the ground, mid-level officers, that level, sat down with local leaders, mm-hmm. tribal leaders, sheikhs, and that sort of thing,
yeah.
and figure what's going on and talk to these people and try to get some kind of understanding to stop the violence. And that's what has actually brought the violence down, not the number of soldiers that you have.
Okay.
That's same thing in Afghanistan. We don't know the local leaders. We don't know the tribal leaders. That strategy is still not there.
Well, OD, you know, it seems to be, from what I'm reading and hearing about General McChrystal, that is part of his strategy. Sean, isn't that? Thanks, OD, for your call. Sean, isn't that part of what he's about as well?
Yeah, first of all, the caller said he did two tours in Iraq. Yeah. I'd like to thank him for his service to the country.
Absolutely.
And yes, I mean, that is actually the one in key area that is being transplanted out of Iraq, that you know, you listen to people who really studied counterinsurgency, you know, say, look, we can do those kind of similar kind of things in Afghanistan. And I actually think that's technically correct. I just think it's tragically too late, and that we've lost that opportunity in southern Afghanistan in particular. So the caller also mentioned something about intelligence, and that's really so key, because in Iraq that is what happened, that local people turned basically on the al-Qaeda. Many were bought out with money. And then they did have a sense of increased security because there were more foot patrols, people on the street, and so forth, combined with a growing legitimacy of the government. But again, you know, we still have the same troop levels in Iraq. They're not really coming out on the timeline that we expected, and there's a reason for that, which is that the core conditions have not been resolved inside of Iraq. So add to that the complex array of situation in Afghanistan, it gets even more difficult there. But the intelligence thing is crucial, because you have to, if you're going to do the counter-terrorist part of this, you know, with the drone aircraft and so forth, you absolutely must have good intelligence and good information. And so the question is, where will that come from? And that's an argument against my argument of, you know, if you pull back from operations in southern Afghanistan, you may cede that territory and indeed lose a lot of good information. But on the other hand, you know, no one's talking about going back to what we had in the 1990s, you know, a very aggressive and punishing use of targeted tactical military force that is driven by intelligence can work, especially if it really goes after leadership. And that has been what's been happening in northwestern Pakistan. And the Pakistanis seem to be increasingly thinking that it's actually working there. So that's another argument to give that element a little more time to work before we start talking about more troops.
What about our alliances with the Muslim world and how that affects our work in Afghanistan? Joe, you wanted to ask about that. You're on the air.
Yes, I did, and thank you. I want to, any comments that I would make about Afghanistan, I would start by thanking the service people and their sacrifices and the sacrifices of their families, which the country is neglecting.
Yes, sir.
And
yes.
So I would like to thank everybody who's serving or involved with people who are serving. I don't think that we can ever expect as a country to be welcome in Afghanistan. The Afghanis are strictly devout Muslims. There are a lot of Buddhists in Afghanistan, as you know, Professor.
Mm.
But the leadership and the power is among the tribal leaders who are Muslims. They don't like us. They don't want boots on the ground. We are infidels to them. But we do have a lot of allies in the Muslim world.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder why we don't enlist the aid of our allies in a more humanitarian aspect so that we can actually help the individuals in Afghanistan. We're spending this national treasure there, and we're not getting any results from it.
Hmm.
I strongly disagree with your point, Professor, about the value of using air power and targeting from the sky. I think that just adds to the disdain that the people in Afghanistan feel for the West, because it exhibits no personal courage and bravery, which is the basis of respect in a tribal culture such as the Afghanis.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would say is that Afghanistan is a sacred land in Islam. It's an area of Islam where there seems to be a regard throughout the house of Islam for the people and the land. So I feel like we're just being counterproductive simply by being there in a military aspect. Mm-hmm. Boots on the ground. Boots on the ground is a non-starter for the Afghanis. Mm-hmm. But we do have strong allies in the Muslim world. And the needs of the Afghanis are great, not just military support, but humanitarian, developmental support, which could be provided by our allies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think would lead to a more suitable outcome. I'll mention that going back in history, after the atomic project, the atomic bomb, the scientists that were involved in that project wrote a book called One World or None, in which it was clear to those scientists that in the atomic age, that if we don't come to a great peaceful accord with the entire world, that we're going to face a conflagration at some point.
Joe, we're running out of time.
Okay.
You want to hear what Professor Kay has to say about this?
Yes, I would. Thank you for the time.
All right. Well, thanks, Joe.
Thanks for the thoughtful comments.
Yes.
One of the – how much time do we have?
About 90 seconds.
Okay. Quickly, the issue of the Muslim world is accurate, and there's a lot that could be done through the UN and other agencies to – capitalize that even further. However, critical allies of the United States are Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, and I'm not sure we're getting the kind of help we need from those allies at this point. So it's a good general point, but at the functional level, who do you go to? There are Turks, for example, in Afghanistan, and there are coalition forces. But the point is right that these are people that could be more of a lead, visible role on the ground. But if we don't get the Pakistan part of that equation right, then all of this will be for nothing. So that's crucial, especially, you know, the hearts and mind in Pakistan as well. On the air power, let me just say really quick, I'm not arguing that should be the sole thing we do. In fact, I think, for example, the bombing that killed civilians up in north of Kabul a few weeks ago was a disastrous use of air power and really damaged our overall mission there.
Okay.
That's not what we should be doing. But if we have good intelligence and we know where they are, then it's a good way to go about it.
We're out of time. I would like to thank my guest, Ohio Wesleyan University Professor Sean Kay. It has been a pleasure. I hope you'll come back. We have a lot more to talk about.
Thanks for having me on.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.